Welcome to the Seven Figure Leaders podcast. This podcast was created to celebrate the success stories of seven-figure business owners, giving them a platform to share their insights and lessons learned in order to inspire other business owners. As well as that, it's an opportunity to build new connections. So if you're a seven-figure business owner or someone who works with seven-figure business owners, and you're looking for introductions to potential stakeholders, strategic partners, and clients, I'd love to hear from you or have you on as a guest and see if I can help make those connections for you. Just go to synergycfosolutions.co. That's synergycfosolutions.co and click podcast. And there you'll find the link to apply. Welcome. And today we've got Mitesh Vekaria from Vascroft Contracting. Welcome, Mitesh. How are you?
Very good, Tom. Thank you for having me on your podcast.
Well, pleasure to have you. Why don't you give us a bit of a background as to who you are and what you do?
So my name is Mitesh Vekaria, and I'm the Managing Director of Vascroft Contractors Limited, which is a family-owned and operated medium-sized main contractor specializing in hotels, high-end residential, and all sorts of other types of buildings. It's probably easier, Tom, to say what we don't do. We don't do roads, bridges, and tunnels, and we do everything else. That's not those three. But yeah, we're a very traditional contractor, sort of 1960s style contractor, where we have our own joinery, our own mechanical team, our own steel yard, and a lot of directly employed PAYE specialist skilled tradesmen and craftsmen, which allows us to be a sort of a mini army and have a lot of skill sets in house and undertake the work we do from cradle to grave, if that's the right analogy.
Okay. Great. So that's pretty wide-reaching stuff. How did you get into it? And it's a, so you said family-owned business. So perhaps you can give us a bit of the history from when you joined the company.
Yeah. So when I say family-owned, it was founded in 1977 by my father and my late uncle, both brothers. They started as jobbing laborers on the Barbican Tower and eventually evolved into doing carpentry work. Became a subcontractor for carpentry and then bought a joinery and then expanded into mainstream construction. I myself am a chartered surveyor, qualified in hotel valuations and agency. And I left the city in 2003 and joined the family business. And I've been here for 20 years plus, of which I think I became MD in 2013, so more than 10 years ago. And it's family owned and operated, meaning, I mean, my siblings, I've got two sisters, Chandni and Druti, who are also in the business doing different parts of the core functions for us to trade. And my father's still there as chairman, sort of the technical eyes and ears and a fountain of knowledge for the team to go to. So yeah, that's the sort of core platform. And my background is property and real estate.
Okay. And so what is the transition that the business has been on since you've been in charge? How's the business grown or developed?
So fundamentally, a good point to talk about is my late uncle, who was 50% owner of the business, he expired 2013, as I said earlier. He had two children, has two daughters, but they were non-operational in the business. And we had to sort of do a little bit of project hygiene or restructure to make sure that the members of the family that are rowing the boat are suitably, you know, remunerated and motivated for the long run. So if you've got 50% of the business being silent but taking 50% of the dividends or, you know, the fruits, it's not as motivating probably for the 50% that are rowing the boat and carrying the blood pressure and the stress of everything else of being, you know, probably in all three parts of the Venn diagram, where you've got owner, owner shareholder, you've got management, then you've got employee. And if you're one in all three, then, you know, something has to give. So what I did was do a tidy up where we managed to buy out the other half of our business so that we could be more streamlined with the sort of members of the family that are operational and owners to be, you know, 100% owners as opposed to 50%. So that's been quite a tricky, but fairly smooth transition to allow next gen succession and also allow our senior management team to come on board with long-term incentive plans in place, because it's very difficult to offer LTIPs when you haven't got the 100% control in terms of shareholdership. Now that we have that, it's the next step would be, how do we enthusiastically engage our senior team into the long run vision? So we're on that journey right now.
Okay. That's really interesting that you said that about the how you navigated the situation of having 50% of the shareholders owned by people that aren't in the business. And I think that's a pretty common situation that people have to get around. How did you go about actually doing that?
So there's two ways. One is you have the conversation to say, knock on their door and say, can we buy you out? Because these are the reasons why. Or they knock on your door and say, can you buy us out? Fortunately for me, it was the second, which said, they knocked on our door and said, can you buy us out? Which, A, you know, prevents that difficult conversation, because they probably see the bigger picture and say, we're ready to be bought out. And that's a healthier conversation, because you're not pushing someone out. They're saying, buy us out, which was great. Then usually the debate becomes, well, great, we've decided to be bought out. What's the magic number? That's always the debate, right? So we were very, very fortunate in that we had to do a declaration to HMRC on our business value following a previous restructure where we had some reporting requirements to report value. So I think the timing was as fluky as, you know, we reported to HMRC a figure in December of that year. And then in January, you know, the other side of the family knocked on our door. And then we said, well, okay, great. Had we known that, you know, we could have planned different investments in the year that we were doing investments, but we will fall on the sword of the figure that we gave to HMRC, because A, it was done with, you know, independent valuers valuing the business for HMRC, and we're reporting that figure of value. So it surely should be right. And therefore, let's not debate it and fall on that sword of the number. So everyone kind of carried on with that. And there was no like, oh, I'll produce my valuations and they'll produce their valuations and all of that toing and froing. It was, you've agreed to be bought out. We fortunately have a number. And those are the two big ingredients. The rest is sort of mechanical, you know, getting lawyers involved to do share transfers and timing of payments and all that sort of stuff. That was pretty more straightforward. And tax advice. We were lucky. Two good things fell in the right place.
Yeah. Good. Okay, yeah. That's really interesting. And so shifting gears and focusing more on your role in the business, what have you been through with the business since then? And what are kind of the biggest challenges that you've faced?
So since acquisition, you're talking about?
Since you took over. Yeah.
So, okay, well, when I took over in 2013, it was a little bit of a baptism of fire, because unfortunately my late uncle, who was the MD at the time, passed away on a business trip in India. So literally halfway through one meeting and the next, he disappeared off the planet, and I had to pick up the pieces, fly out and work out what his meetings were and who was who. And, you know, you're going into sort of a blind Bermuda Triangle and trying to work out what these projects are about, because they were his projects managed independently. We learned a lot on succession planning, disaster recovery. We also shared a lot with other families that were in similar structures where they had, you know, a certain captain leading the overseas business and a certain person doing domestic business. And we said, it's not the right structure, or let's have lots of good meeting minutes after you've gone and done a business trip abroad about what's happened and what the actions are, because somebody could fall dead halfway through and it's a catastrophe. So good lessons learned on that front. In terms of the UK business, we actually had a construction arm in Dubai for the last 30 years, and we closed that in 2020, just around following COVID, because we lost our GM to COVID out there, and I didn't want to recruit a new team remotely for a construction business that had been running for 30 years. So what I did was tidy up the amount of plants and pots that we had around the world in terms of having to water them, nurture them, trim them, and care for them. I just felt that was too much on our plate. So instead of expanding globally, I was contracting globally to focus on the UK, because that's where we've been, that's our hub, and all we've done is spread our wings but diluted our time across that geography. So for me, the strategic shift big time was, let's trim down and then focus on the UK business. So when I joined in 2003 is when I've joined the business from the city, I think we were turning over 13 million. And today we've just closed at 75 million. So there's a reasonably good growth year on year of revenue. Just to add that we don't chase revenue, but it's become a measure in the industry. But if we have a decline in turnover, we haven't got city shareholders or, you know, the stock market to sort of convince or, you know, explain why turnover has dipped. We're a privately owned family business, and if it's dipped, we're still profitable, we're happy, and we are really nurturing, retaining clients, repeat clients. And, you know, we are a cog in our clients' processes for property development or, you know, hotel industry, you know, expansion. So as long as we're profitable and we're looking after our people, because our people are like family for us. So a number of members of our staff have been with us for 30 years. So that's a long time for, you know, retain skill sets, knowledge, management ability, and general confidence for our clients to know that we've got the right skill sets in house to deliver some of the complex projects that we do. So, you know, we tend to get the difficult jobs that no one wants to touch in terms of logistics, constraints of access, you know, time, and the detail of quality. So those are the kind of jobs that Vascoff normally picks up and delivers. For example, at the moment we're doing a private members club next to the Peninsula Hotel. And that's going to be one of London's leading pubs, you know, 60,000 square foot of space. And they've spent a good fortune on getting it to like the high standards that a central London members club would expect. And we've done hotels like the Dorchester through to, you know, the largest Holiday Inn Express in Europe at Terminal 5. So a broad range of hotels, and then we've done super luxury houses in Mayfair and the home counties. So a good broad experience for our business.
Yeah. So that is very broad. You said something that I would love to go into a bit more detail on. So you talked about essentially globally contracting and then doubling down on the UK. So I do this with my clients as well, where you're essentially trying to work out what's working, what's not working in the business, painting a picture of which areas of the business, whether it be product line, service line, or geographical location, are making money, which are losing money, which are worth it, which aren't. And then obviously you cut the, maybe they weren't quite losses, but the less profitable areas and doubled down on the UK. But in that process, you've gone from, I think you said 13 mil up to 75 mil, which is huge growth, just by doubling down and focusing on what you are best at.
Yeah. I think that's really well summarized, Tom, because, you know, when you're growing, you're thinking, okay, we're doing this well, why don't we repeat this in another geography? So that's how Dubai sort of became the point. And when we went to Dubai, we're talking about 1992, you could see the Trade Center from Jumeirah Beach. Okay. I don't know if you know Dubai, but now you cannot see, you know, more than 50 meters from Jumeirah Beach before you hit a tower that blocks your view. So Dubai was a small little place that everyone knew everyone. It was very personal, and we've seen it grow over time. But what happens is you tend to do projects out in the Middle East, but you hardly get paid your last payment, because that's just the nature of the Middle East, where they seem to think it's okay to not pay you your last payment. And that's, you know, in construction, that tends to be where your profits are, your last payment. And you don't get that. So you're constantly on a sort of a cycle, a hamster wheel, where you think, okay, we'll get the next job and that will make the last one better, and, you know, we'll get on with it. And you never get out of the rut. So we cut our losses when we actually lost our team, you know, the person running our helm, our ship out there. And I said, okay, enough's enough, because it was diluting time. Now, time is, you know, most valuable, because we're doing it for 30 years and we should have been quite successful in terms of being a very profitable business, but we weren't. So the review was, where are we profitable? We're in the UK. The UK was holding up the fort around the world, wherever there's losses, but be it, you know, property in India or litigation in India because of the real estate market. You know, it's very difficult to try and get clean title in India, in true clean title in India, because someone somewhere will come out of the woodwork and say, I own some part of this land and you don't have clear title to it when you thought you had. So you become, you know, your development pipeline gets paused whilst you try and de-weed that whole process of someone claiming rights to your land. So everywhere you go, it's slightly different territory, slightly different regime, customs and traditions, and they become new markets for you. So you can spend time and energy learning about it and trying to implement and navigate a way around it. Or you can say, well, you know what, we've been in the UK since 77. We're well established in the sector that we're in. You know, we get invited to do projects. And we may as well focus on that because it makes us, you know, we're not traveling as much. We're here. And your time is valuable. And then you've got the work-life balance as well. If you've got family growing, you want to be available there and not be on a plane at the other end of the world. So those are the kind of things that you can weigh up and have done. And that's what we've done. So, and it's been a good decision. So the only downside now is that, you know, the UK economy isn't showing signs of good growth prospects for the next, you know, foreseeable future. And that is a concern because, yes, we've got rid of all of our overseas sort of avenues that we had on the basis that we'll focus here. So you can't have it all.
Yeah, you can't have it all. I think there still is a lot of growth, especially in London, despite what you hear in, you know, in terms of averages across the whole economy.
Yeah.
So in terms of what's next then and growth from here, you're at 75 mil revenue. Is it just a case of more organic growth?
Yeah.
The team here, doubling down on the UK more?
Yeah, it is more organic growth, which is what has been the path up to date, which is, you know, as I said, we're not chasing turnover. We take a dip. It's okay because we want to make sure that our team of 300-400 people are, you know, fully engaged on a project and we're managing that pipeline. It's a bit like finding hay for, you know, a big elephant to eat, you know, so you've got to make sure you've got just enough ahead of us to keep the whole wheel of the business moving in the right direction. So as one project is sort of completing, we're looking at another project to put that team onto and another team from another job as they come to an end to keep everybody gainfully employed. And that's just been the focus. So we haven't got like a 5-year plan saying we know what we're going to be doing in 5 years. We're looking at 1 or 2 years because the life cycle of projects is a client might have bought a building now, they're going to do a planning gain on it or a planning turn on it, and then they're going to implement it or sell it. So us looking ahead 5 years is a too long pathway for us because, you know, just as the way our clients are in terms of their sectors. Answer your question, are we thinking 75 will be 100? Well, if it does, it does. What we're keen to do is to make sure that we're still producing the correct quality of work. I mean, we do a lot of temples. We've built 9 temples in the last 3 years. We're doing one in Paris at the moment. And, you know, those temples are real, like, you know, the old Indian craftsmen, you know, coming in from various parts of India to do, you know, stone, actual masonry work, you know, to produce these sort of really ornate traditional Indian temple buildings. They're a bit of a work of art in themselves. And we've created a kind of a niche where we get invited to come and do projects in Europe and UK. So there's a lot of expertise that we have in-house, and that's our USP.
Brilliant. And so I'd be interested to understand as well, what is your role in the business? Obviously, you run it from an MD CEO perspective, but day to day, presumably you've got a leadership team who take care of all of the day-to-day operations. So are you focused just on maybe larger projects, not the day-to-day of larger projects, but just relationship management with larger clients, or kind of what are you doing?
Yeah, so I think you've summarized that well. I get involved with looking for the next stack of hay, right, for us to sort of get onto. But my key role is that I will be involved in all projects from the very beginning. So, you know, it's from a tender or an invitation, you know, pre-qualification questionnaire, all the way through to I do attend every monthly progress meeting for every single project. So that is my touch point where I know the client team, maybe not the principals of the client, but their appointed teams will be there. They can have event or an interaction point with me to say this is not working well for us, or we need you to focus on this because this is a real risk for us. And I can, if I'm hearing it firsthand and it's not through reports and, you know, other bits of data, nothing's lost in translation. If they want to swear at me, they will. And if they want to thank me, they will. And that's the being available. And that is very important, because otherwise we're just another main contractor and they're just a statistical client for that main contractor. There's no sort of personality to it. And we started as a small two-man business in a van and a box room. And we've tried to keep that ethos. I mean, my dad's very, very keen on nurturing that through the business, where a client calls. I mean, my phone's available 24 hours a day, as is my dad's, and as are some senior members of staff, because the client is happy that they've got someone that they can phone at the end. And, you know, something will be done about it, as opposed to, you know, wait till Monday morning. It's nothing like that. We're always available. And that is the service. At the end of the day, we are a service provider. We might be running a big corporation, but we're no different to the barber, the mechanic, or the baker, or the chef. We are a service provider, and it just happens to be that our service involves bricks and mortar. But that's what our clients want, is to be able to have a personal service, and that's one of the key roles that I will have involvement in. Obviously, I've got a great senior management team, so they're like the first rank of like generals, as you might call it, and they are running their independent projects. And I will see them because I see them every month at the progress meeting. But in between that, we'll be discussing general progress, procurement, and I'll walk the course randomly anyway, so I'll know what's going on. But that's just, you know, having being out there and you know, visualizing what you're being told on reports, so you makes sense to establish, you know, the correct path at that point.
Absolutely. Well, that is really exciting and really interesting to get into the weeds with what's going on at Bazcroft. So is there anything else you want to share with the audience, and any message that you want to share, or anyone that you're looking to get in touch with or want to contact you?
I mean, the message for us really as a business is that, yes, we're family owned and operated, but a lot of our ethos is giving back to the community. So we have the Bazcroft Foundation, which is a big part of our charitable arm. And the business, you know, the company staff, they all know what the foundation does. It helps humanitarian causes around the world, helps in educational projects and philanthropy generally. But it's good for the team to know that, you know, when we're building these community buildings, wherever they are, that is a CSR hat. It is not done for full profit that we would have in the commercial world. Equally, whatever we are doing from commercial projects, a large chunk of that every year goes to the foundation, which then in turn supports other charitable ventures, be it youth hostels or, you know, hospitals or different causes, be it cancer or research in different medical grounds. That's a big part of, you know, why people probably stayed with us for a long time, is because there's a good work-life balance, but there's also like, you know, a CSR responsibility that we hold very highly. To answer your specific question, yeah, listen, we have a big industry problem where we haven't got the right intake of apprenticeships and skill sets being replaced. And that is something that we have been concerned with for a number of years, where we supported local colleges sponsoring, you know, students to come in and do certain experience days, and also sponsoring the colleges so that they've got the right funding to do, you know, to address the shortages that we tell them that we need in our industry. But we're a small little, you know, dot in the comparison of like the industry as a whole. And yes, the government needs to do more, but at the moment I think, you know, we have a general problem in the industry. And I think it's not just our industry. I was listening to the radio the other day, and there's just issues in different industries about a shortage of, there's a sort of a pause on training and intake, and now you're going to feel the impact of that. They're trying to address it.
Absolutely. Okay, brilliant. Okay, Mitesh. Well, we'll make it easy for anyone to get in touch with you. We'll put a link to your website and LinkedIn profile in the show notes. But thank you very much for coming on as a guest. Really interesting to hear about Bazcroft and your journey that you've been on. And good luck.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you for having me.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Thanks for listening. As I mentioned at the beginning of the episode, this podcast was created to celebrate the success stories of seven-figure business owners, giving them a platform to share their insights and lessons learned in order to inspire other business owners. As well as that, it's an opportunity to build new connections. So if you're a seven-figure business owner or someone who works with seven-figure business owners and you're looking for introductions to potential stakeholders, strategic partners, and clients, I'd love to hear from you or have you on as a guest and see if I can help make those connections for you. Just go to synergycfosolutions.co. That's synergycfosolutions.co and click podcast. On that page, you'll find the link to apply.